Hi, this is Martin Andelman from Mandelman Matters, and this is a Mandelman Matters podcast. It's number 3 of my scam prevention series.
Well, it's the bottom line for you right now. You had your chance and you let us down.
Today, my guest is none other than the man who has sued more banks than anyone in the country, a lawyer who has won 101 out of 102 jury trials, and has trained over 900 attorneys across the country to represent homeowners, a hero of the foreclosure defense movement. I'm proud to call him my good friend. Who else could it be but Max Gardner?
A loan's been paid off by a credit default swap. Is that ever true?
That's never true. No.
Never.
That's never true. The idea that you're going to go to a lawyer and pay that lawyer your mortgage payment for 2 years to get you a free house, that's just not going to work. That's not going to happen. If there really was a magical way to make all this go away, I think it would have happened sometime about 4 years ago. I've heard the argument that, well, I didn't make the payments, but the servicer did. The servicer's making the advance, in effect, for you. It's a corporate advance against your obligation, so it doesn't eliminate your obligation to pay because the servicer made that advance.
It doesn't mean you're not in default because the servicer...
It doesn't mean you're not in default, no.
Right.
You're still in default.
If you go out and file a quiet title and lose, are you going to get hit with the legal fees?
If you lose the case, they're going to add their legal fees, you know, from Covenant 9 and the standard deed of trust and note has that provision in there. So that's going to be added to the debt you owe, whatever legal fees they incurred, and they can be substantial. If you really and truly are serious about litigation, it's going to be an expensive proposition. It's going to be a long-term type thing. This is not like suing Jack's Mini Mart because you went to buy 7 Coca-Colas and they only gave you 5.
Some people dance in the rain. Some people can't stand the shame.
The banks, and they've got regional firms throughout the country that are very, very big law firms, hundreds of lawyers and paralegals. And if you take legal action, then that's who you're going to end up with, is a very, very large law firm that has plenty of assets that they can throw against you, and they're going to throw them. There's no quick fix. There's no simple solution. There's no magic bullet here. There's no easy route. It's not there. And anybody that tries to tell you that, you know, I've got an automatic fix and we're going to cure all your problems, just give me $10,000, everything will be beautiful. Run as far as you can, as fast as you can from that person.
This says if you deny the debt, that automatically means the note can't be evidence of anything real because the note refers to a loan between the originator and the borrower where the borrower unknowingly received the money from a third or fourth party.
No, that's so far in bizarre land that it's not even hardly worth commenting on.
See, this is the kind of stuff that goes out every day, and people, they read it and they think, okay, I'll do that. And that never works, right?
That's never going to work, Martin. That's going to make sure that you're in and out of court pretty fast, in my opinion, because your case is going to be thrown out.
This rumor about how you'll never have title. If you paid off your house and then you didn't get your note or you didn't get it released, that's when you'd file quiet title, right?
Yeah, that would be the time you would take legal action to force that deed of trust or mortgage to be canceled because you actually had paid it off.
Okay.
And there's certainly remedies that are available for that situation. There is that bond, that emotional attachment, and when they're facing a foreclosure, people are desperate, and unfortunately, there's a lot of folks out there that are taking advantage of those people. And I'm not talking about the servicers, the banks. Now, listen, I've sued more banks and servicers than anybody, so I'm not saying that we're dealing with the Truth and Honor Society here, but I'm saying that there's a lot of bad stuff going on our side. There's no free house, there's no free ride, there's no quiet title. We're not going to be able to cancel this mortgage or deed of trust. What we may be able to do is to modify this loan. The climate for modification is better today than it's ever been, in my opinion.
And here's the man who needs no further introduction, the man LPS lawyers least like to see,
Max Gardner. All right, I'm here with my favorite guest, Max Gardner, consumer bankruptcy attorney, Max Gardner from North Carolina. Max, are you with us?
I'm here, Martin.
We're here as part of the scam prevention series. I had to call Max right away and say, help with this. This is important. You've heard everything by now, haven't you?
I think I've heard and seen and been exposed to and infected by everything, Martin.
I mean, you've heard every argument surrounding this whole foreclosure crisis, I think that's imaginable. The credit default swap audit and the securitization audit and the insurance paid off my loan three times and all those things. Well, I'm going to hit you with those. We're going to see what's true and what isn't.
This is a true-false test. I hated those in law school, Martin.
Right. It's a true-false test. Well, people just need some straight answers.
I agree.
Believe.
No question about it. There's a lot of misinformation and disinformation
right out
there.
And I don't blame the homeowners. After you live in a country where HSBC was guilty of money laundering for terrorist organizations and Mexican drug lords.
They've got to deposit those funds somewhere, Martin.
Good point. Yeah, I know. It's a good point. You live in a country where you see that, and it just sort of, you get a fine for that, or you forge a million documents and you pay.
Well, my new slogan is, if you can't pay the fine, don't do the crime.
Yeah, that's good. That's very good.
Yeah. If you can't pay the fine, don't do the crime.
Right. It's not do the time anymore. It's just pay the fine.
No, it's not do the time. No,
right.
It's the new rule of law, so to speak.
Yeah,
if you can't pay the fine, don't do the crime.
That's very good. That'll be the title. That'll be the headline for this podcast. If you can't pay the fine, don't do the crime.
Well,
robo-signing certainly was a bargain.
And it's fairly inexpensive, too. I mean,
it is.
The good thing about it, I mean, like, you know, the LPS settlement, $7 per fraudulent document.
Was that what it was?
Times a factor of 4 or 5. It worked out pretty good, and the stock went way up as soon as they did that settlement. So the investors were happy.
I'm sure they were. The DocX thing was, what, $2 million to the state of Missouri. The state of Missouri went cheap. So while we're talking about that subject, what do these settlements mean to homeowners? I mean, that's the first question. What does it mean?
It means that the state attorney general has extracted a civil penalty from LPS or a servicer or a bank or whoever it may have been, and that money has been paid to the state, and each state has various statutory and constitutional provisions about how those funds can be used. In some states, that money has to go to the general fund. In some states, it has to go to the school fund. I mean, it just depends on each state.
But does it mean
it's not going to go to the homeowners? And
right. Well, of course, that goes without
and
saying.
And, of course, the agreements are, you know, are not an admission of any liability by, like, LPS, specifically in the agreement, and it doesn't give the homeowner any right to enforce any breach of that agreement.
So you can't
remedy for the homeowner.
You can't go to court and say, look, Your Honor, this has now come out in the National Mortgage Settlement, and therefore this somehow helps my case.
Well, there's maybe some very creative ways you could, like on the 49 state AG settlement, they have some very specific servicing standards in there. Now, the homeowner certainly cannot enforce those, but you could argue that those standards set a best practices type of minimum that must be met. And if a servicer doesn't meet those, that maybe they violate your state unfair and deceptive practice statute, or if the servicer acquired servicing rights when the loan was in default and is subject to the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, then maybe a violation of those servicing standards also violates the FDCPA. But it's an indirect type of claim. The consumer homeowner certainly doesn't have any direct cause of action for breach of these settlement agreements.
Now, that's a good question. The Fair Debt Collection Practices or either of those, will that help in any way with my foreclosure case?
It can help. It's like I try to tell my clients, and everything that I do, I think, you know, is through Chapter 13 bankruptcy. I use the Chapter 13 platform as the basis to litigate all these claims. But, I mean, the ultimate objective is to try to get a modification of the loan that would involve a principal write-down, an interest write-down, doing something with the arrears, doing something with all the fees and charges, taking care of all that, and to establish what I would call an affordable payment. I mean, it's a two-level analysis. One is, can we find enough legal leverage to, in the bankruptcy context, to get a settlement that would involve that kind of modification. And then the most important thing is, if we in fact can get the loan modified, does the client, the consumer that I'm representing, can they afford to make that modified payment? I mean, you've really got to be realistic, and I think people have to make some very difficult decisions, and that's the most important one, is to really do a very granular monthly budget and look at what the probabilities are of getting that loan modified, what the monthly payment's going to be, and include your interest in property taxes and in any homeowner association fees or whatever other fees may be involved in the ownership of that house, and then decide, if we can get to this point, can you make that payment? Let's get realistic. If you can't, then maybe homeownership is not going to be something that is going to be doable for you now.
So it comes down to a modification. I've been taking sometimes a lot of heat for this, saying modification is by far the way people are saving homes.
That's the name of the game for me. I mean, it always has been. My boot camps, what we try to teach is how to get the necessary legal leverage, this legitimate, valid, acceptable claims, where you can find that there's something that's been done wrong by the other side, whether it's a servicer or a subservicer or LPS or third-party vendor or the actual owner of the note, whoever it may be, and then use that. So what we want to do is get this loan modified to an affordable payment, and that's going to involve all those factors I mentioned, and not just saying we'll put the arrears at the end of the loan and they'll start making the regular contractual payments next month. That's not a modification. I'm talking about complete restructuring of the loan. That doesn't mean, I mean, there's this idea out there that somehow at the end of the yellow brick road there's a free house. If that's the way you're perceiving it, somehow I'm going to get a free house, or this idea about I'm going to quiet title to the property, I mean, that's just smoke and mirrors. It's not going to happen, and those kind of cases have created real problems for those that are serious about trying to pursue this the right way to get a modification.
When you hear about somebody getting a free house, it's one in a million, right? Exceedingly rare.
Oh, I'm sure it's happened. I've got a case where they filed a foreclosure and they had some defects in it, and they filed a voluntary dismissal, and then they refiled the case about 6 months later, and again, we identified some defects and some affidavits and documents, and they took a voluntary dismissal again. Now they've filed the third time. We've got a rule in our state that if you take a voluntary dismissal after dismissing once, that second dismissal is an adjudication on the merits. So that means that maybe they've lost the right to foreclose. And that's a case where I think the attorneys on the other side just, you know, totally screwed up. Doesn't have anything to do with a securitization audit or a default swap or anything like that. It's just a procedural screw up. And
now, will they still owe the debt?
It's still going to be up to probably our appellate courts to decide, well, what does that mean if you've filed two foreclosures and voluntary dismissed both of them, and our statute and rules say that if you do that, that's an adjudication on the merits against you. Does that mean you can never foreclose? We'll wait and see, but that may be one of those rare cases where you may get a court ruling that, because of procedural missteps by the other side, they're in a position where they never can foreclose, and you may be able to file an action to get that where deed of trust state, get that deed of trust removed.
But would you still own the debt? Would you still owe the money?
I think the foreclosure is a separate action from just suing on the note itself, you know, to try to get a civil judgment. And if I was on the other side, I mean, I would make the argument that, well, maybe we have judicially stopped ourselves from foreclosing, but we haven't sued on the note yet, so we can still do that. So, you know, we'll see.
Right.
But I wouldn't say that the fact situation I just mentioned would be one that would automatically preclude just a lawsuit on the note, like for money owed. It's like somebody would sue you on a credit card.
Right.
You didn't pay your credit card, so you owe us, you know, $18,000.
Yeah, so it's exceedingly rare. I mean, very rare that kind of thing happens.
Very rare, yeah.
All right, so you hear people say that my loan's been paid off. I hear this more and more every day now. My loan's been paid off by three times, by insurance and by a credit default swap. A loan's been paid off by a credit default swap. Is that ever true?
That's never true. No.
Never.
That's never true. If I'm an investor and I buy, say, the AA bonds in a securitized trust, you know, I just own those bonds. And I may go out and buy insurance, a credit default swap or an interest rate swap. It's really like you're buying insurance. Like I went to AIG in 2009 and said, hey, I bought these AA bonds in a securitized mortgage trust. It says it's going to pay me a full and two and a half years, and it's going to pay me a certain amount of interest. I want to be sure that I get paid. How much do I have to pay you to guarantee that I'll get paid? And AIG, you know, sets a number, and I pay them, and that's a swap deal where I'm paying them to insure my bond. And then if the deal goes really, really bad, that is the securitized trust, you know, AIG may have to pay my bond. But that has nothing to do with the note that is actually owned by the trust. I mean, as a bondholder, I have no ownership rights in that note. A good example would be, you know, what if I was a stockholder in Ford Motor Company? Do you think I could go up to Dearborn, Michigan or somewhere and walk in the plant and say, you know, guys, I'm the owner of this plant. I want everybody out of here by 5 p.m. because we have a party. As a stockholder, you don't actually own the assets of the corporation. The corporation's a separate entity. You just have an investment in it. It's the same way with these bonds, same concept. So the fact that a bondholder may have been paid from an insurance product, or maybe there was a residual cash strip in the trust that was going to pay the first losses, paid the bondholders, that has absolutely nothing to do with the obligation of the homeowner under that note. Those theories are totally false.
There's a difference here at the loan level versus the bond level.
You're talking about two different animals. I mean, you're talking about apples and oranges, two different things altogether here. And, you know, another argument I hear is that sometimes they'll make the argument that notes in a securitized trust are actually owned by or assigned to certain tranches. You know, you've got your AAA and AA's and single A's and triple B's and double B's, and each one of those is an investment tranche. But that somehow my note was actually owned by the double B bondholders. And therefore, if the double B bondholders were paid in full or paid anything, somehow that paid down my note. There's no such animal as that. The bondholders have no interest in the individual notes. They're buying an interest in the investment stream of income that entire trust generates, and they have no interest in any individualized note.
Right. In a securitization, as you taught me at boot camp, you know, when they pour, the money gets poured in and the top tranche fills before the next tranche and on down like a champagne fountain. So the money
structured finance just means that the highest grade bonds, the AAA,
get paid first.
Are going to be paid first before they're all going to get interest each month normally. But we're talking about paying down principal, paying the bond off. So the AAAs are going to be paid off before the AAs are paid off. And then the losses go from the bottom up. So if a D bond is the lowest rated bond in a mortgage-backed trust, then if that trust doesn't perform as projected, the first losses would go to the D bond, the lowest tranche. So the losses go from the bottom up. The payments go from the top down. In 20 words or less, that's what structured finance is.
Right. So what's happening here, though, is someone told me just last night there was a homeowner I was talking to, and she said that she didn't believe that any money went into these trusts. And I was like, well, that couldn't be right. I mean, no money went
into these. Yeah, but no, that's, I don't know where that comes from. But the underwriters went out and a lot of these deals were pre-sold. I mean, you know, that's what the prospectus was for. The prospectus supplement that's filed with the SEC for a public deal is the way the deal looks when everything's in. The prospectus is basically telling your investors, this is the kind of products we're going to put in this trust. Now, we haven't bought anything yet, but we intend to buy these type of mortgage products, and it's going to have this geographic diversity, and we think FICO scores are going to range from 650 to 725, and these are all going to be fixed rate mortgage notes. And so the underwriters will go out and actually pre-sale the bonds, and they have the money, and then when the notes are aggregated and ready to close the deal, then you have a closing like you would when you went and bought your house, where, you know, you actually had a closing, you signed all these papers and documents and forms and disclosures and everything else. Money really changed hands. There's no doubt about that. I mean, it was real money. These people were in it to make money. I mean, how do you think the brokers made their broker fees and when you know, New Century would sell a note to an aggregator for 105 basis points. I mean, that was real money. If they had a $100,000 note, they were selling it for $105,000. So that's how they made money.
Right.
And there was real money involved in this all the way up and down the line.
And
everybody was making money.
And when the service, when you make a payment, when you make a mortgage payment, it goes to a servicer, and the servicer obviously knows who owns the note. He's sending the money to the trust, right? I mean,
yeah, the servicers normally, you know, have to remit payments. The 25th day of the month is the normal day, but they remit the payments to the trust, and they have to file these loan level reports. It could have as many as 25 or 30 data fields for each loan that are available to the investors, and that's how people that access the ABSNet and Bloomberg terminals, that's how really people like Jay Patterson and Kevin Byers, two very good people I use, that's how they really track a loan for me into a specific trust, is they just look at the investor reports. Servicers file each month because they're loan-level reports. You're going to tell the investors on loan number 104789, the current principal balance is this. We collected this month. This was applied to principal. This to interest. This to escrow. We dispersed this much to you. We took our servicing fee out. We may have had some corporate advances that we also took out of our remittance, and here's the amount we dispersing agent for the trust who then dispersed the money to the bondholders.
Right. So you know exactly what's going on in the investment you bought, or you get a statement every month.
Yeah, right. I mean you just don't, somebody just doesn't come by your house and leave $500 on the front porch.
Right.
Walk out the door and say, hey, where that came from.
Right. And servicers, whether the legal paperwork was correct or not, the servicer knows which trust it is because the money comes in every month. They send, they don't just go, what do we do with this? I don't know, put it in a drawer. They know where the money is going, so they think
absolutely. I mean, whether the paperwork is right or not, or whether the notes were transferred pursuant to the contractual documents or not, everything is imaged in, and they have very sophisticated data centers and informational centers and software programs and everything else. So they know when I make a payment on my mortgage, they know exactly where that money is supposed to go. They've got to know it to know what fees and charges they're allowed to take out or not take out. And
right.
Some deals are different. So the servicer has to know that. And it's very easy. I mean, you know, put the number in the computer terminal of whoever the service tech is that's processing that, and bam, it pops up.
And they send the money there. It's like, see, I think
they send the money. Yeah.
I think people heard, they heard people say, well, the notes were never transferred to the trust. And some people kind of thought that meant, well, they're not, the trust isn't getting the money. But that's two different things. They're getting the money.
Two different things. They're getting the money. In fact, I mean, the biggest expense that a servicer has, and you really have to have some serious lines of credit to be a servicer, because it's expensive to be a servicer. But I guess anybody in the business would agree with me that the biggest obligation a servicer has is, if I don't make my payment on my mortgage to my servicer this month, the servicer has got to advance those P&I payments to the trust.
Right.
And they're going to have a credit facility to make that advance, because that's going to be a receivable that they're owed back by the trust, because they're advancing the P&I payments. And they can factor that or pledge it as collateral for a loan. But you've got to have that kind of warehouse line of credit or some kind of credit facility to have that money, because that's the biggest cost they have. And they have to continue to make those advances until it's determined that any further advances wouldn't be recoverable if the property was foreclosed and sold as real estate owned. And if the servicer and the trust make that determination, then the servicer can ask for termination of the obligation to advance P&I payments, even though they're not being made. And that's not a credit either. I mean, I've heard the argument that, well, I didn't make the payments, but the servicer did. I don't owe the money anymore. Well, no, the servicer's making the advance in effect for you. So it's a corporate advance against your obligation. So it doesn't eliminate your obligation to pay because the servicer made that advance.
Right. And it doesn't mean you're not in default, because the servicer...
It doesn't mean you're not in default, no.
Right.
You're still in default.
I hear that all the time. Well, the servicer is making the payments, therefore the loan was never in default. No.
It was in default, and therefore there was no right to foreclose. That's a separate legal transaction, a separate receivable that's been created. It's a corporate advance against your loan, and actually increases the amount you owe.
Now, in terms of insurance, is there any such thing as insurance that if I don't pay my mortgage, it pays off my mortgage for me?
Well, you could have credit life insurance if you died. It would pay off your mortgage. That there's some disability-type policies that would pay enough to cover your mortgage.
Right, but those are things I would buy. I would pay for.
Those are things you would go out as a consumer and pay for, yeah.
Right. That people seem to think that somehow they took out a mortgage and the servicer or the bank was able to get an insurance policy that pays my loan off if I don't pay it. And I've tried to explain to people, you know, did you fill out a health questionnaire? I mean, if any insurance company that's going to pay off your mortgage is going to ask if you have AIDS, for example, I mean, right? Who's going to insure
you?
Well,
if that happened, the insurance company, if insurance company insured a note for a trust, let's just make it a simple transaction, and a contractual default event occurred where the trust could force that insurance company to pay the trust the current face value of that note, then the trust would, the insurance company would simply be subrogated to the rights the trust had in that note.
Right.
And the insurance company could then foreclose on the note or collect the note from you. That doesn't just pay it off. Kind of vapor money theory. There's this kind of this vapor money theory that's out there.
Yeah, there was never a loan made at all, and it was all just they created money out of thin air, and therefore there's no real money. If it's not backed not backed by gold, there's no real money or something. It's like, wow, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there are different versions of that vapor money theory out there. None of them are accurate at all, and I'm not sure exactly what kind of vapor the people were smoking when they came up with that theory. But
Maybe they
should move to Washington or Oregon or somewhere.
Right.
Now,
look, there's a different thing here about this whole, I get a lot of flack sometimes. People will say, well, loan modifications are fraudulent. And I'm like, well, what do you mean?
Or what?
They're fraudulent because you're never going to own this house. You're never going to have clear title to this house. And I just can't envision that. I'm like, look, if you pay off your house, you're telling me I'm never going to own my house? Are you worried about that at all?
If my client pays the mortgage off at the end of 23 years or whatever the term is left that we agree on, and they don't satisfy that deed of trust or mortgage of record, then...
Let's just play it out. So you pay off your loan. Well, then Bank of America is going to release the lien, right? You pay off the loan.
Well, we've got a statute in North Carolina, like most states have, a satisfaction statute. They have 60 days to satisfy that of record. That is to go to the registered deeds in North Carolina and mark that deed of trust as satisfied. And if they don't, then the consumer has the right to file a civil action for, actual and punitive damages and to get an order forcing them to do that and to get your legal fees.
The other thing is, I've heard from all different lawyers that if the banks are pushed enough, when push comes to shove, they do show up with a note. You know, they don't like to do it, but if they're pushed to the end, they show up with a note. Has that been your experience too?
Eventually, they're going to come up with some document that they're going to represent that is the original note, and they're going to have some endorsement on the note that is an endorsement in blank, which under the UCC, the Informal Commercial Code, creates bearer paper, and their argument is going to be whoever holds that paper is a party with the right to enforce the note, and the vast majority, of course, have accepted that Article 3 of the UCC argument.
The note might not be endorsed properly. There might be problems with it, right? But they show up with something. They do produce something. Is there a way, I think I've asked you this before too, I've asked different lawyers around the country, there's a way to fix these things, right? In other words, I was talking to Aquin, they said they'd spent like $1 million on a title law firm in Chicago to fix the process. Things like designated signers and things like that. There is a process for fixing this. It's just time consuming or costly, right? It's not that they can't do it. I mean, it's not that it can't be done.
Well, I think that when most of the originators back in the day before the Great Recession, they lived off warehouse lines of credit. And by that, I mean that the money that they loaned to consumers on either originations or refinancing of mortgages, that was money that they got from, Wells Fargo or Chase or Bank of America through maybe a $1.5 billion or $500 million or whatever line of credit. And what they would have to do is deliver the original note each day to a document custodian that was designated by the warehouse lender. And that custodian would have to certify that they had the original documents, the note, deed of trust, title insurance, HUD 1 statement, that type thing, and that everything looked in order. And if they made that certification and the warehouse lender would release the line of credit represented by that note to the originator. And they would use that to fund the loans. And that's really how they operated day to day. I mean, even the biggest one, you know, the New Centuries, for example, they lived off their warehouse line of credit. And then when you would get ready to securitize those notes, and they might do that once every 2 weeks or so, I think, you know, that's where the problem started, is whether those original documents were actually properly transferred from that original custodian to maybe a custodian for the trust, or did that same custodian remain the custodian for the trust documents. And I think the volume just exceeded the ability to process the documents the right way. So I think somebody out there has got the original documents, hopefully somewhere, whether they have all the contractual documents, like the mortgage loan purchase and sale agreements between the originator and the sponsor and the sponsor and depositor. You know, I don't know, because law firms usually kept those agreements and a lot of those firms aren't around anymore. And custodians usually did not keep those contractual documents. But, you know, I think that's where the problems came into the system, where they had to recreate documents or create allonges or stamp endorsements, because they just didn't do it. But they signed the contractual documents. There's no doubt about that. Money changed hands.
Right.
And you're talking about real money that was changing hands. I mean, people weren't doing this for free. Everybody was making money in the transaction or they wouldn't be doing it. But I think if you know, there's ways you can legally remediate problems, ways that I think under, you know, I make a big thing about Article 9 of the UCC that hasn't been mentioned by many courts at all and really hasn't been effectively argued by anybody. But, you know, Article 9 makes it pretty clear that if you have a contractual document that complies with Article 9 and you have a complete unbroken chain of those documents, that you're going to have automatic perfection in the deed of trust or mortgage if you're the party that bought that note in an Article 9 transaction. And that really undercuts the whole argument about MERS, really, if you think about it, because what Article 9 basically says is if you sell the notes pursuant to Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code by proper Article 9 contractual documents, then automatically, pursuant to Article 9, which is in every state, the deed of trust or mortgage automatically follows the sale of that note without having to record anything with the local land registry, the register of deeds. So I think there's a lot of ways they could remediate the paperwork problem. I think it's, in my opinion, and has always been, it was more of a volume exceeded capacity problem.
Yeah.
You know, and there was just too much going on. And you've got to remember back in 2005, 2006, and this number is pretty startling, but I remember at the time, and I think it was. You know, put out by Fannie or Freddie, that the average life of a mortgage loan in the United States was 2.5 years. And that was the median, which means some people were refinancing every 3 months or maybe every 6 months. So if you had that much volume, and if somebody, you know, got into a default situation in 04, 05, or 06, you would just refinance them into a higher interest product. They wouldn't qualify for the 4% loan anymore, but they might be able to get a 7%. And that's how you cure the default. So
right.
I think that there was no pressure on them to really make sure that the paperwork was all in order, because why should we worry about it? This loan's going to be refinanced in 6 months or a year or 2 years at the most anyway. It's not going to matter.
That's why they wouldn't do the paperwork in advance, right? They do it if they're going to foreclose, they do it.
Yeah, I think, and then when you know, the wheels fell off and starting in 07 and then definitely in 08 and since then, the volume of, this system that the servicers have, the whole mortgage system, was never set up. It was never built to deal with the level of defaults and foreclosures that we have. I mean, you know, back in 2002 and 2003, underwriters, the rating agencies were forecasting the worst case scenario. You know, the doomsday scenario for any trust would be the default rate would maybe hit 2.5 or 3% of the notes in any trust. That would be the worst case scenario. And I think servicers would have had a hard time dealing with that kind of a default rate. And then you see some deals where the default rate is 35% or 40% of the loans in a trust are in default. you know, the system was just not built or structured to deal with that kind of a that kind of a problem.
Right. So, but these trusts haven't all by any means imploded. I mean, people are still getting payments. People are still making payments. In certain trusts, you might have higher default 30-40% default rates, but otherwise, they're still paying. AAA bondholders are still being paid.
Yeah, I think the investors have, in my opinion, put a lot of financial pressure through civil litigation and administrative remedies on the trustees for these trusts and the various servicers for the trust to modify loans, because it's always going to be in the best interest of a bondholder, who, when I say investor, I'm talking about bondholder, to make a non-performing loan performing, especially in today's market. If they foreclose on a property, there's not going to be any money coming into the trust until that property is actually sold to some third party, like me or you or maybe an investor that's buying a property to rent out. And that's when they're finally going to get paid. And the market is not what it used to be. Home values are not what they were, no matter what people are saying. And you've got a long time lag to from the time you foreclose on a home until somebody comes and actually buys it from the real estate agent you listed that home with is real estate owned to be sold. So I think especially for the upper grade investors, the people that own the highest rated bonds or the entities that own those bonds, it's always in their best interest to turn a non-performing loan into a performing loan, even if you have to drastically modify the terms, because they know if they get, you know, there's 30% performing, that they're going to be paid out on time and in full. So to me, I think the there's some good in the Attorney General's settlement. I think that's put some pressure on servicers to modify loans, because that's how they get credit on the financial obligations they've signed up for, is to modify loans. And, you know, whether they own the loan determines how much credit they get, whether or not they just service the loan. You've got a lot of trusts that are now forcing originators to buy back loans that were misrepresented to the trust, breach of reps and warranties. Fannie and Freddie have been doing a lot of that. You know, they forced Bank of America to buy back millions and millions of dollars of loans. So the climate for modification is better today than it's ever been, in my opinion.
Yeah, and getting your loan modified, first of all, it's really the way to save the house. And second of all, you're going to own the house. This rumor about how you'll never have title, where does title insurance fit in? Doesn't that protect anything?
Sure. I mean, everybody's got title insurance. You can't get a mortgage on a house without title insurance. And if there's ever a problem, the title insurance company's going to come in and defend it and pay it. That's what you get it for.
And if you paid off your house and then you didn't get your note or you didn't get it released, that's when you'd file quiet title, right?
Yeah, that would be the time you would take legal action to force that deed of trust or mortgage to be canceled, because you actually had paid it off.
Okay.
And there's certainly remedies that are available for that situation.
Now, these things that you're talking about, where you say, you know, the note and it might not be endorsed properly, whether it's Article 3 or 9, it's a very technical argument. Can the homeowner do anything about these things because they're being foreclosed on? Can they go in and say to the judge, well, this wasn't endorsed, it's signed, something's wrong with this? Is that actionable? It didn't go in the REMIC trust. What do we do with all these facts?
Can the homeowner do it on his or her own? No, I don't think they can. I mean, I just think that's a recipe for disaster for a homeowner to think they can make these arguments to the court themselves. I mean, there are not that many attorneys that are knowledgeable enough to make these arguments to the court. The Uniform Commercial Code was not everybody's favorite course in law school. The judges went to law school, and the judges, I mean, it's like, you know, oh, come on, let's talk about something else. We don't want to talk about the UCC. So all these are very technical arguments. And the thing that I think has really created a lot of problems for the lawyers that are really trying to do this the right way are the pro se individuals who've tried to take these cases on themselves, and they've come up with all these kind of bizarre theories and legal concepts that really aren't legal concepts. The vapor money, the default swap, the insurance paid it off. Since the servicer paid the payments for me, I should get credit for that. All these theories have created a lot of bad law, and that has created problems for the attorneys that know what they're doing and are trying to do the right thing. To me, you know, you've really got to sit down, like I said before, you've got to make a decision. Number one, there's no free house. There's no free ride. There's no quiet title. We're not going to be able to cancel this mortgage or deed of trust. What we may be able to do is to modify this loan, and we may be able to get an affordable payment for you. Let's assume we're able to get this kind of modification. Let's do a real budget right now and let's see if you can afford to make this payment. And I think that's where you've got to start. And I think you really need a plan, and the idea that you're going to go to a lawyer and you're going to pay that lawyer your mortgage payment for 2 years to get you a free house, that's just not going to work. That's not going to happen. And you're putting off the inevitable, the final day of reckoning is going to come. So I think you really have to have a realistic plan. To me, being realistic about what your ultimate objectives are going to be, and that is to get that loan modified.
Let me ask this. I've been recently saying to homeowners, because they start to tell me about what their case is, and I've been saying, look, I don't know about your case, but I can tell you this for sure. Suing your bank is never quick, cheap, easy, or certain. It's always hard, expensive, time-consuming, and you might lose. Is that always true? I mean, isn't it always that way?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing the banks, they've, for the last, I would say, 3.5 years, really emphasized the process of escalation. So if we have a lawsuit that's filed against us because we started a foreclosure, whether it was judicial or non-judicial, they're going to take the firm, the volume firm that, you know, just processes thousands of foreclosures a month. They're going to remove that firm and get a very large law firm. The banks, and they've got regional firms throughout the country that are very, very big law firms, hundreds of lawyers and paralegals. And if you take legal action, then that's who you're going to end up with, is a very, very large law firm that has plenty of asset that they can throw against you. And they're going to throw them. It's going to be an expensive proposition. It's going to be a long-term type thing. If you really and truly are serious about litigation, you have to have a lawyer that's going to be willing and able and confident enough to take depositions, pretrial testimony of witnesses. And that's a very expensive thing to do. You know, a deposition, talking about thousands of dollars per deposition, just in the cost of getting a court reporter to transcribe and produce it. And if you video them, that's another big expense, plus the expenses of your lawyer and going to Dallas, Texas, or Minneapolis, or Jacksonville, Florida, or the Los Angeles area. Anywhere you have to go, that's expensive. And then you've got the lawyer's hourly fee involved in it. So this is not like suing Jack's Mini Mart, because you went to buy 7 Coca-Colas and they only gave you 5.
Now, I just got one in. I just want to run this one more, another thing by you. Here's what the advice going out today is, that your defense to this foreclosure should simply be, Your Honor, we don't know these people. We don't know the debt they are claiming. We have no idea where this is coming from. We were induced to sign papers that withheld vital information about the party with whom I was doing business and left me with a corrupt title.
Well, you know, if you look at every uniform note and mortgage or deed of trust, it says right in there, in every one of them, that I understand that this note will probably, most likely, almost certainly be sold, and that the party that actually ends up buying that note and ultimately owns it is going to be the party that has the right to enforce it against me. And that's right in the contracts that you sign. So, you know, the idea that this is not the party that I got the loan from, that's, to me, a non-starter.
This says if you deny the debt, that automatically means the note can't be evidence of anything real, because the note refers to a loan between the originator and the borrower, where the borrower unknowingly received the money from a third or fourth party.
No, that's so far in bizarre land that it's not even hardly worth commenting on.
See, this is the kind of stuff that goes out every day, and people, they read it and they think, okay, I'll do that. And that never works, right?
That's never going to work, Martin. That's going to make sure that you're in and out of court pretty fast, in my opinion, because your case is going to be thrown out. You know you got the money. I mean, you know, you closed the house. I mean, where the money came from, what their source of funding was for whoever closed that loan for you, I don't know that makes any real difference. You signed the papers. You got the house. You moved in, turned on the electricity, and put that down as your address, and got cable TV or whatever. You got garbage service and everything else, water, sewer, all in your name. You're there. You just didn't magically move in that house. You know, it just didn't happen like somebody clicked the clicker and all of a sudden you're sitting in this house. No, I didn't want to get here, you know.
Right. And there's another one just went out. It said that they're giving advice that homeowners should look at the Kentucky AG lawsuit, because if it's good enough for the Kentucky AG to put it in there as a claim, you should put it in your lawsuit.
Well, you know.
See? It's out of control.
The one thing I would say, I mean, it's like this. I have a lot of forms that I produce and make available to the attorneys that attended my seminars. But a form is only as good as the facts of your case. I mean, there really is a form is, I think, something that will give you ideas about maybe I have this legitimate claim in this case. And if I have it, then this would be the way I should plead it. But you just can't grab things out of the off the internet and just plug them in and right. say, "Oh, this is a good one to put in this case." I mean, everything's got to be customized. This is not a cookie cutter thing. This is not like producing widgets and they're all stamped the same. Every case is different. The facts are different every case. You know, what happened or didn't happen is different every case. So the idea that you can just grab claims from here and there and they'll work is, that's not the way the legal world operates.
They sell these turnkey quiet title package. You can buy it online, $14.95, whatever, there it is.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this question. Can you get in trouble for this? If you go out and file a quiet title and lose, are you going to get hit with the legal fees?
Well, you know, you can have a double barrel loss there because you have the fees you paid to your attorney, and then if you lose the case, they're going to add their legal fees, you know, from Covenant 9 in the standard deed of trust and note has that provision in there. So that's going to be added to the debt you owe, whatever legal fees they incurred, and they can be substantial. I mean, these big firms, you know, a lot of these partners, $800, $900, $1,200 an hour, and they keep time records in 15-minute intervals. So if you have a one-minute phone call that goes in the system, is 15 minutes. That's the minimum that the system will take. So you can get some pretty staggering legal fees.
So the bottom line here is there's no magic bullet. This is very difficult. There's just nothing that a homeowner can just quick pick up and do. I mean, it's just, we'll close out this one. This is what not to do. And then can we come back, you know, next week and do something where we talk about what people can do?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think there's some legitimate things that certainly people can do, and it's not just out there in never land by themselves with no remedy. The problem is when you get a situation this bad, you get people that want to take advantage of the consumers. And I'm not talking about the banks or the banksters or the servicers. I'm talking about these forensic loan auditors and all this. I mean, the only thing I really need to know in a case is who is the actual owner of this note right now. And, you know, I can, like Jay Patterson, who is a CPA and an auditor that I use in Arkansas, Jay can go and get me a report that has all the documents that are in it that I need for $75.
Yeah.
It would take me more time to do the research myself. You know, I might have several hours to get what Jay could get me for in a matter of 10 or 15 minutes for $75 or however long it takes Jay to do it. But that's why would I pay $1,500 for some forensic loan audit that would tell me the exact same thing that I'm going to get from Jay Patterson for $75, plus links to all the SEC documents. If everything is online, Jay's going to do the Fannie lookup, the Freddie lookup, the MERS lookup as part of that $75 package. And I see people have come in and paid $3,500 for a forensic audit. And the thing is basically regurgitation of how securitization works. And then they may have had access to the Bloomberg terminal and actually looked up the stuff and will have the trust that this loan is in. And it's very distressing, I have to say that. And you know, there are attorneys out there that are taking advantage of homeowners too. It's not just forensic loan auditors. I mean, there are attorneys that are certainly misrepresenting what they can do. These mass class action or mass tort things, I'm not sure what they're called out in California. Some of those cases are truly bizarre in my opinion. But the thing is that there's no quick fix. There's no simple solution. There's no magic bullet here. There's no easy route. This is not like, you know, getting Google Maps out and seeing what's the quickest way for me to get from Shelby to Charlotte and just, you know, let the voice guide me down the interstate. It's not there. And anybody that tries to tell you that, you know, I've got an automatic fix and we're going to cure all your problems and just give me $10,000, everything will be beautiful. Run as far as you can, as fast as you can from that person.
Anybody that tells you this is going to be easy, it's not. And there is no magic fix. If anybody could write a check and it'd be over, that's what everybody would do. right?
Yeah, I mean, if it really was a magical way to make all this go away, I think it would have happened sometime about 4 years ago, you know, or 3 years ago, or 2.5 years ago. I mean, the fact that we've been in this for really 6 years now, 2007, I think that if there had been some super-duper legal remedy that somebody uncovered that would fix everything like magic, that, you know, it would have been in widespread use and we wouldn't have any foreclosures going on and the world would be beautiful and everything would be right with America. You know?
Right. Like, if there was really something paying off all the loans, there wouldn't be any losses. Investors wouldn't have any losses.
They wouldn't have any losses. There wouldn't have been any need for any kind of government intervention or anything. Had the Great Recession or anything like that.
I was actually told the other day that there are lawyers that are winning all the time, but they, of course, don't tell anybody about it because then they're afraid the judges wouldn't let them win anymore. I went, really? Modest lawyers, they're winning, but they don't tell anyone. It's secret winning.
Secret winning, yeah.
It's secret winning.
Well, you know, lawyers just don't work like that. I mean, if a lawyer wins a big case, they want everybody to know about it.
Right
off the bat. And you know, in today's age, I mean, if I just got an email last night from one of my boot campers in Maine, and the Maine Supreme Court issued an opinion in a case involving Freddie Mac, and he sent me the opinion last night. The opinion just came down February the 7th, yesterday. So, you know, and I get things that quick throughout the country, and
yeah,
that's the way things are today. If people really get good opinions, there's so many listservs and all these social networks, you know, Facebook, to LinkedIn, to everything else that's out there, that these things are become, for people that are really seriously involved in this, this is all, you know, almost instant information. I mean, we know that the good cases, the bad cases, the really bad cases, the really good cases, the not so good cases.
Right.
You know, they're reported that, I don't know, I've never heard of this idea that there's this secret society of lawyers who are winning cases and not telling anybody, and the judges aren't telling anybody.
Right.
I guess they're not writing opinions. I don't know. I mean, that sounds like the, you know, something from a Star Wars type movie to me.
And I would think you're about as plugged into this as anybody could ever be, right? I mean, come on. I mean, how could I get things from you every day. That's how I know. I mean, I get cases from you that you think, you know, it's like, you got to look at this. You know what's going on all over the country.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's been a very, very difficult slog. I mean, it's been like climbing a mud hill that's a very, very steep hill, and there's somebody at the top that's got a major faucet running water down it. So that's how hard it's been to try to get some traction with the legal arguments. I'm talking about really valid legal arguments that you can make on behalf of a homeowner or a consumer in this area. There's nothing that has been easy about anything that we've done. I'm talking about real, solid, legitimate legal theories. But the end game has always been, the end game that's always worked has always been, let's see what we can do to get this loan modified down to a payment that my client can really afford to make. And those that have pursued an end game of, we're going to get a free house or cancel the mortgage or eliminate the debt, or, you know, that's a game that there is no end to. How exhausted are you going to be before it's over, both financially and emotionally?
Oh, I think it's taking a terrible toll on people. Just a terrible toll.
It takes a domestic toll. I mean, if you're in this situation and bought into some of these bizarre theories and strange theories, and you paid for some sort of forensic audit or whatever it's called, there's this kind of cloud of uncertainty that's over you and your family and your house, and it creates a lot of domestic problems. People get tired. The uncertainty, the fear, the unknown is always out there. Maybe the husband wants to pursue it and the wife doesn't, or the wife wants to and the husband doesn't, or whether we're talking about any kind of family unit at all, no matter what it is, there may not be unanimity on what to do or how much longer we should do this or how much more we should pay into this. And you know, the emotional domestic toll is heady, is what I would say on it. I mean, living with uncertainty is stressful.
Yeah.
There's no question about that. You know, you don't know. That's why I think, you know, you've got to have a realistic end game here, because if there's no possibility that this family or this party, whoever it may be, that they can make that modified payment. If that's just beyond the realm of possibility, then they need to make a decision about, all right, should we try to just do a deed in lieu, or try to work something out with the servicer? They may pay us $3,000 or $5,000 or $10,000 just to move,
right,
and deed the house back to them, and then they can use that money to transit into a rental property, and maybe in 3 or 4 or 5 years they're going to be able to really buy a home that they can afford at that point. So I think those are the kind of decisions you've got to make with people. I mean, you've got to get down to a realistic level. And you know, one of the problems I have is people come in with, you know, expectations that are based on things they've seen on the internet, or, you know, heard from friends or relatives or who knows where, about so-and-so got a free house or so-and-so got this, and that's what they want. And you've kind of almost got to debrief them. To say, you know, go through what we're going through right now is, no, that's not going to happen. That doesn't work. No, that's not a viable legal theory. It's really made it difficult for, I think, the attorneys that are trying to do the right thing. And, you know, attorneys criticize me for modifying loans. I mean, I made a deal with the devil. I know better than the attorney generals or anybody else. Or how can I sleep at night because I signed a deal with Bank of America to modify a client's loan? And how do I know that they really and truly own that note? But I sleep at night, and I've got a lot of clients that are sleeping at night in their home, and they sleep a lot better because they know that they've got a permanent modification, and they feel like they got a realistic chance of making those payments.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I have that same thing going on. So if I can help one person at a time, that's all I can do. We're going to authoritatively eventually shut this down. We're going to make it so hard on people to lie that eventually they'll have to move on.
Well, yeah, you know, I hope that's the case, because when people get desperate, and, you know, a home is the number one asset that most Americans have, the American dream and all that, we're talking about something that means a lot to people. There's no question about that. And people have strong ties with their homes. It may have been a home that's been in their family for 2-3 generations or longer. So there is that bond, that emotional attachment, and when they get in a financial position where they can't afford to make the payments on that home, they're facing a foreclosure. People are looking for anything that they think may help them. People are desperate, and unfortunately, there's a lot of folks out there that are taking advantage of those people.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about the servicers of the banks. Now, listen, I've sued more banks and servicers than anybody, so I'm not saying that we're dealing with the Truth and Honor Society here when we're dealing with servicers and banks, but I'm saying that there's a lot of bad stuff going on our side with people that are offering these magical remedies and potions for a lot of money. They're not offering the forensic audit for free, I don't think.
No. I talked to a guy, 54 grand, some people got him for $54,000. That's why next week I will call you. We'll do something on the solutions, what people can do and how to find the right lawyers and what they can do to start or help themselves. And we'll go over that. Let's go. Let's provide people real solid information. All right, Max.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah. Okay, Martin.
Thank you. I'll talk to you next week. Yep. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. That was Max Gardner, consumer bankruptcy attorney from North Carolina. Probably the leading authority in the United States on these subjects. And you heard what he said. I know you didn't like hearing that. I know you didn't like hearing it. It really isn't the point. You need to hear it. It's the truth. So everybody knows, it takes hours and hours to produce one of these podcasts. 8-10 hours. I don't do it just to make you miserable. And I'm certainly not doing it for the money, because there's no money in it. I do it because you need to hear the truth.
We might make it. That sun sure shining bright today. After all the hard times we've been through, next year's finally here to stay.
Because we need to take our power back. We need to get through this crisis. Help is not on the way. It's up to us. We're not going to do that by having our facts wrong or believing in things that aren't true. And I'm just not going to stop until I've made it so damn difficult for anybody to lie to a homeowner that it just isn't worth it anymore. So I hope you found it interesting, and I hope you found it valuable. This is Martin Mandelman for Mandelman Matters. Thanks for listening. And this has been a Mandelman Matters podcast.
I believe we might make that sun show shining bright today. All the finally here to stay. Neighbor Jim sold his herd last fall. He's getting old, said he's getting out. If you need anything, you just give him a call. He'd come on by and he'd help us out. He says, I believe we might make it. That sun sure shining bright today. All the hard times that we've been through, next year finally here to stay. After all the hard times that we've been through, next year's finally here to stay.